Happiness is a mindset. It's a way of life, and we're talking about it here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Secret Society of Happy People was founded on this day 30 years ago. It was later renamed the Society of Happy People. Nevertheless, the goal is for people to make an effort to recognize and even talk about their happy moments as much as they do their unhappy ones. Perhaps more, because happiness is more fun. So what brings you happiness in your life? Is it something small or big? Perhaps something in between? Do you intentionally make time for happiness, and how do you do that? How does it make you feel? We're at 800-642-1234. Pamela Gail Johnson is the founder of the Society of Happy People, which is based in Texas. The society has thousands of members from 45 identified countries. Pamela, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me this morning.
So
good morning and happy Thursday.
Yes, happiness happens day. Lots of H's there. So why should we be making happiness a priority right this very moment in our lives?
Well, I think it's important to make sure that we try to at least keep happiness in balance with our unhappiness, I guess, if you will, or we like to call them just happiness zappers. Some are bigger than others. Something like, I think nationally right now, people are a little bit in shock and there's some grief going, there's obviously in certain communities a lot of grief going on, but I think there's a ripple effect of the nation's kind of grieving. And so sometimes that's like a bigger type of unhappiness than, say, traffic or somebody was rude to you at a store. And so I think it's important to, try to keep the types of unhappiness, if you will, our happiness zappers, in balance. And so hopefully you have at least as many happy moments as you do unhappy ones.
Help us understand where we might see happiness zappers in our day-to-day lives.
Well, we have four practical happiness principles, and one's called, happiness zappers zap everyone. And we try to divide them up into, like I said, unhappiness, because everybody also experiences what I kind of call real unhappiness, and it's not going to just go away because you just don't like it. I mean, it would be nice if it did, but it doesn't. So those are those big kind of life-changing moments that people have. And then we have just what I call stress, which is, there's just normal stressors in the course of a day. And in fact, some stress can even be good for us. So we don't always think of stress that way, but there's just like normal stressors. And we sort of know that they're just, unless they're connected to unhappiness, they're just part of our daily life, and you manage them. And then we have annoyances. And I think these are the places where we can really try to manage them even better. We let annoyances and even chaos, I'd like to divide it into a couple of other categories. Those are things that are just, for the most part, temporary, and you somewhat get a choice on how long you let that zap your happiness. So annoyances are somebody's rude to you, somebody's just annoys you for whatever reason, or a situation annoys you. But the question I always like to ask myself or suggest others ask is, will you remember this a year from now? Most of the time you're going to say no. If you do say no, then you should just, drop it, because it really is something that's just zapping your happiness. You're allowing it to. In fact, you probably won't even remember it next week.
You started this day 20 years ago, initially calling it Admit Your Happy Day. Why did you want to start this day in the first place?
Well, the society was actually a year old. It was our first birthday. So the society itself is 22 years old. And there weren't really any happiness holidays at the time. There were a lot of the disease days. There were some fun food days. There were some sad days. There were just a lot of sad days we recognized. So our first birthday was coming up, and it was myself and a group of our kind of charter members were like, what can we do to celebrate our birthday? And we were like, there's not a happiness day, so there should be a day saying, hey, when you're happy, admit it. And if you're not happy, we certainly never encourage people to pretend to be happy, because there's nothing more annoying than that. But, you know, when you are happy, embrace those moments.
Mm. We're talking with Pamela Gail Johnson about happiness. She's the founder of the Society of Happy People. Do you purposely make time for happiness? And if so, how do you go about doing that? How important is it to celebrate moments of happiness in your day-to-day life? Call in with your stories, your ideas. 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Pamela, earlier this year, the World Happiness Report came out with new rankings on happiness levels of over 150 countries. Not good news for the U.S. We fell to number 19, and that was our worst showing ever on the ranking. What do you think explains that?
Well, I think America is somewhat in a transition phase. I think we actually, the last study I saw as a not in the World Happiness Report, but, you know, we're more depressed now than we have been, depressed, anxious, stressed, than we have been since the Great Recession, as they call it, in, I think, 2011, whatever year that was.
2008.
So, and I think there's a lot of things that contribute to that. One is I think people in general get nervous about, I think healthcare is like this anxiety people carry with them, because even if you work at a great company and you have company insurance, unless someone's ill, you're not sure that, you know, how good your insurance is, meaning they may or may not, you know, pay for medications or procedures that people need. And then you have a whole other host of people who don't have appropriate or, you know, what we call good insurance coverage. So I think people do walk around with an anxiety about that. If somebody gets sick, is you know, am I going to be okay? That's sort of a new anxiety in the last decade. We also live in this world of what I call competitive happiness because of social media. So people are, you know, judging other people's happiness based on a picture on
Instagram,
whatever social media platform you like.
Sure.
And it's particularly predominant amongst teens, but it is even predominant in adults. You know, I know people who have actually gotten off certain social media platforms because they get upset if they don't get enough likes or, you know, loves or retweets or whatever, you know, the platform is. And I know when sometimes people have told me this, I'm like, wow, because that's something you're not in control of. Like, you don't even know who sees what's in your feed. That's controlled by an algorithm. So that would impact your likes and loves. But I know adults in their 30s and 40s that have it, you know, it stresses them out. And if it does, you probably shouldn't be on those platforms. But I think that's a contributing factor. Like I said, we watch, you know, like I said, feeds, and we assume somebody's life is their feed. I think we also are just, we're also now living with another new anxiety of domestic terrorism, for lack of a better word. You know, when you go places, you're not sure that they're going to be completely safe. So everybody's sort of on an alert system that maybe we were only on at one point when we got on a plane after 9/11. I think anybody who flew, especially right after 9/11, you certainly were in a heightened state of anxiety when you got on the plane.
You kind of feel like there's no place that's really sacred anymore.
You have workplace violence, you have school violence, you have now shopping violence, festival violence. And so, like I said, it's just a subconscious thing, I think, that everybody carries with them that adds to stress and anxiety. And I have not seen a study on that, but I just still think it's there. So I think those things are contributing to our stress and anxiety, which the World Happiness Report does take into account.
We're talking about Happiness Happens Day, checking in with its creator, Pamela Gail Johnson. How do you make other people happy? Do you go out of your way to flash a smile or make someone laugh? Are we taking happiness as seriously as we should be in the U.S.? Join in with your observations, your questions, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about spreading happiness on this Happiness Happens Day. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. People in the U.S. ranked as the unhappiest they've ever been based on the recent 2019 World Happiness Report. We've been talking about how the U.S. fell to number 19. Finland is the happiest place on earth. Other studies also show that people are feeling more stressed and depressed and anxious. So where do you find moments of grace? What brings you happiness in your life? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. The founder of the Society of Happy People, Pamela Gale Johnson, stays with us. Pamela, is it more important to seek happiness for ourselves each day or to try to spread it to others?
Well, studies actually show that when we do acts of kindness or actually even something as simple as a smile, somebody probably will smile back at you, you know, naturally. So I think when we're helping others, we're also helping ourselves be happy. So I think both are important because I think you also can't give something you don't have.
Mm.
But if you are needing a happiness booster, just go do a quick RAK for somebody and you'll probably smile. It can be as simple as, you know, opening a door or helping somebody carry, when their arms are full, carrying in some packages for them. It doesn't necessarily have to be some big grand gesture. It could be getting them a cup of coffee. Most likely, when you do those little acts of giving, little acts of kindness, it will, you know, cheer you up as well.
So is it selfish to set happiness as a goal for ourselves?
Well, I think happiness in some ways is the goal. You know, we have a pursuit of happiness, which is, I think, instinctual in us, just like our pursuit of, you know, being on alert. That's sort of also part of our DNA. We grew up in, you know, we were, the caveman is part of our DNA ancestry. So we, you know, are naturally on alert to some degree to make sure wild animals aren't attacking us. And for survival, I mean, that is a part of our, again, how we're hardwired in our brains. So we do have to make a little bit of an effort to notice happiness when it happens. That can become your habit. So the society actually has 31 types of happiness. So I think people sometimes need to broaden their definition of it to expand how much happiness they may have. It's one of the easiest ways to see more happiness in your life is when you know, recognize more moments that are happy when they're happening.
You've been thinking about smile givers recently, people who make us and the world a happier place through just a smile. What are some habits we can learn from these smile givers?
Well, we actually are launching our campaign for the 20th Happiness Happens Month. It's called the Smile Starter Awards. So people who make us smile for whatever reason, so it could be that they did an act of kindness for us or just something super simple, or it may just be our friend that we like to call because when we hear their voice, we're smiling and laughing, or it could be your child or your dog, just numerous things that, or cat, because we don't want to forget the cat folks.
Don't leave them out.
The pet folks, you know, like it could be numerous things that are what we call your smile starter. So we actually have a big, I don't know why I said it's such a big goal, but we have a goal between now and however long it takes to recognize 1 million smile starters. The society actually recognized 40 official smile starters, and the happiest country for the past 2 years is on that list. So there's a lot of different, you know, there's a lot of different reasons somebody wants to smile. There's a lot of studies that show smiling benefits us, even if you have to fake it initially. So if you stand in the mirror and look at yourself and you smile back at yourself in the mirror, it's going to start producing some of those endorphins that make you naturally a little bit happier. So smiles are just the universal language of happiness.
We're talking with Pamela Gale Johnson about happiness. She founded the Society of Happy People. You can join in 800-642-1234. So how do you make others happy? Do you feel like you have to give yourself permission to be happy? And if so, why? Are you one of those people who smiles to others in the grocery store or as you pass someone on the street? Why do you do that? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Pamela, one of the places where people can seemingly be the most unhappy is at work, while often there's only so much we can do, especially if we're in a job that you might not like. Do you have any ideas for how to find those moments of happiness at work?
Well, I think work, just like life, isn't going to be all happy. So I think recognizing that is important. I think if you're actually in a job, you know that you wake up for every Monday morning or whatever day your work week starts, and you really, really don't like it, if you can consider other job options or figure out why you don't like it. Sometimes we get bored with a job, and so we're really more bored. And then once we become bored, we start looking for everything that's wrong with it. That's more obvious. So I think that's just something everybody always has to consider, because when we learn new things, we're happier. So again, if we get bored, just kind of figure out if that's your dislike at happiness. But if you're dealing with, let's say, chronically cranky coworkers or a boss that's not necessarily ideal, I think there are things you can do to better manage your happiness. For one thing, make sure you count every single time something goes right. Every single time something, you get like a win and you're like, yay, that project's finished. Give yourself a check mark, and literally give yourself a check mark on a notepad or a whiteboard or in your phone, however you want to do it. But make sure you're counting every single time what's rights are happening at work. You may try to find a work best friend. That's one of the best happiness indicators for people, is when they actually have a best friend at work. It might not be your best friend in life, but a work best friend that you can go on breaks with or go to lunch with and just, you know, talk about whatever you watched on TV last night or the kids' soccer game or whatever it is that's going on in your lives. But that's a real key to happiness. And always trying to make sure that you're being the coworker that you want others to be. And that doesn't mean letting people step on you, but it does mean making sure that if you're frustrated at work, that you're not mirroring that back to everybody. So try to be positive and be the person that people also want to work with, and then they will hopefully reflect that back to you.
Pamela, you've spent decades with thinking about happiness, acting on happiness. What has been your aha moment about yourself on this journey?
I think the biggest aha moment comes, it's in my practical happiness principles. It's like number three. It's like happiness changes as you change. So when I think about happiness, things in my 20s, 30s, 40s, they've all somewhat changed as to what makes me happy. It's not that what was making me happy in my 20s didn't make me happy then, but it might have changed for my 30s, for example. So I think that's probably my biggest aha, or maybe sometimes I didn't understand what somebody else was going through when I was a little bit younger. I didn't understand when people would reach this point. Let's say entertaining for the holidays. In my 20s, I loved entertaining and having parties and everything about it, from the guest list to the theme to the cleanup. I've noticed as I've gotten older, I'm sometimes now like, do I need to do a party for that, or can I get an invitation to someone else's? And I wouldn't have understood that with when I was younger. I didn't get when people go, well, I used to do all the Christmas decorating, and now I just do a little tree. Like, I didn't understand that. And I'm somebody who looks like a Hallmark Channel movie at Christmas. And now I'm at that point. I'm like, do I really need to do the two big trees plus the four small ones? Or can I just do two?
So you're thinking about scale these days.
Well, to some degree, because I think about, like, well, how long is it going to take me to clean it up? And I'd probably rather read a book versus spending 3 days setting it up and 3 days cleaning it up. Like, I'm like, that's a book. If I can shorten that down to a day, well, I can do something else I would prefer to do.
What you're saying there really reminds me of all the to-do lists we have each day and the little things in life, like making sure the bill gets paid on time and that it's in the mailbox at the time, and just all of these little things in life. Are there any tips you have on maximizing our happiness when life has so many other details that take away our attention from the present and from just feeling?
Well, I think one of the things about our to-do list is we always have to remember is it's never going to get finished, ever. It's always a growing part of our lives, because when you mark something off, you're going to add something else. So I think the most important thing to do is remember that most of our happiness, and if you look at the happiest countries and you look at the happiest work cultures and you look at the happiness in any place, it really does come when we are actually connecting with people. So your to-do list is going to be there. Try to put your bills on auto pay, but your to-do list will be there. So make sure you don't miss your people moments because of a to-do list. Make sure that you take time to connect with people, because ultimately your people experiences are probably where you find the most happiness. Now, if you're an introvert like me, like I said, you might start looking at, it takes me 3 days to do this, so I'd rather read the book.
Well, Pamela, thank you for joining us.
Thank you guys for having me on.
Pamela Gail Johnson is founder of the Society of Happy People. Coming up, you have a line to Wisconsin's Secretary of the Department of Health Services. What health issues do you think are most important for our state government to address? Join in back after this news update on the Ideas Network. We have the DHS Secretary here on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Thanks for being here. Democratic state lawmakers said this week that they will try once again to expand Medicaid in Wisconsin as allowed under the Affordable Care Act. So this is a standalone bill that is currently circulating for co-sponsors. Medicaid is where we begin our conversation with the head of DHS. Do you think Wisconsin should expand Medicaid under federal health law, or is this the wrong move for our state? What questions do you have for the leader of Wisconsin's Department of Health? Join in at 800-642-1234. Andrea Palm is Secretary Designee of the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, DHS. She formerly worked for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services throughout the Obama administration, serving as a senior policy advisor for public health agencies. She was a top advisor at the White House Domestic Policy Council during the rollout of the Affordable Care Act. Secretary Palm, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, Kate.
So it's been almost a decade since the Affordable Care Act was passed. How is it working here in Wisconsin?
It's a great question, Kate. I think one of the things that this governor and that this administration is really interested in doing is making sure that people understand the benefits of the Affordable Care Act and the positive implications it has had for health care in this country. Obviously, 20 million Americans now have coverage as a result of the Affordable Care Act, including many here in Wisconsin. We do believe, right, we need to finish that job by expanding the Medicaid program. But I think one of the things that you will absolutely see from this administration and the Office of the Commissioner of Insurance, and I have launched a partnership to do just this, which is to increase enrollment in Medicaid, to increase enrollment through the private marketplace that was established under the Affordable Care Act, to get more people connected to high-quality, affordable health insurance while we continue to press for the protections that are critical in the Affordable Care Act, the pre-existing condition protections, the ability for folks to keep their kids on their plan through the age of 26, the fact that we all are eligible for preventive services at no cost to us is because of the Affordable Care Act. And so we are going to do what we can to help people understand the positive implications of the Affordable Care Act and protect those protections that are really pivotal parts of the law as we fight to expand the Medicaid program and join the 37 other states who have already accomplished that goal.
Do you see any ways that the Affordable Care Act could be improved, like tweaks that you wish you could make on it?
Mm-hmm. So I think there are always improvements that can and should be made. And, you know, healthcare evolves like other things, and so there will continue to be. I think what we know and what we hear is that Americans, Wisconsinites, continue to struggle with the cost of care. Transparency in the healthcare system would help us know what we're buying. It would help us understand what the costs are. A little transparency would go a long way in helping reduce some costs. I think, you know, you saw in the governor's budget some transparency proposals related to the cost of prescription drugs and increases in those costs. Those are areas, I think, where we could be doing some important work to help consumers understand the cost of things and help put a little public pressure in the area to help reduce costs. But there are other things we certainly could and should be doing as it relates to care coordination, making sure that our resources are managed in a way that we're getting the biggest bang for our buck through reducing duplication and being better coordinated. I think there's important work we could and should be doing in the behavioral health space. I think the integration of mental health and substance abuse treatment services into healthcare is a place where we could really see important gains in the health of people.
And I want to get there to the behavioral health piece in a moment, but Governor Evers, as we know, has made expanding Medicaid a real cornerstone of his election last year. It was a big piece of his state budget. But we know Republican lawmakers are soundly rejecting the idea. So do you believe Wisconsin needs the Medicaid expansion? And do you think it can get it?
Yeah, I think we absolutely do need to expand the Medicaid program. I think it is the fiscally responsible thing to do. I think the public, the people of Wisconsin understand that it is an opportunity to return their hard-earned tax dollars back to the state to make investments in them.
But how do you negotiate with Republican leaders who say, absolutely not?
Well, you know, earlier this week, a number of members of the Democratic caucus introduced a standalone piece of legislation. We will use that vehicle to try to gain additional support, to continue to talk about the importance of doing it. There certainly are Republicans who have expressed an interest, who have expressed a common sense understanding of the need to save the state of Wisconsin money and bring back those federal dollars. And so we will continue to look for Republican allies, for folks who are willing to stand with us to support the expansion publicly. And we will take the case to the people of this state to continue to talk to their members of the legislature about the importance of the expansion.
We're talking with DHS Secretary Andrea Palm, and you have a line this morning at 800-642-1234. What health issues do you think are most important in our state? What health issues do you want the DHS to address? What do you think state authorities should be working on? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Secretary, let's turn to the opioid crisis. And your agency says the number of opioid-related deaths here in Wisconsin has nearly doubled in the last decade. How do we combat this epidemic?
This is a really important question and does, you know, as you suggested, dovetail really nicely with a broader behavioral health conversation. I think the opioid epidemic is something that we have struggled with nationally as well as here in Wisconsin. I did have the good fortune of being a part of a team at the federal level who was able to help secure $1 billion that resulted in grants here in Wisconsin to help fight the epidemic. There's lots of evidence around what works, reducing prescribing, increasing access to medication-assisted treatment, supporting folks who are in recovery. There's emerging evidence around peer support and other models that help folks who are who have beat the addiction to maintain their sobriety and their recovery. And so we will continue to build on the progress that the previous administration did while they focused on this issue. One of the things in the budget was funding for a hub and spoke model of care, which has some evidence from around the country about its potential effectiveness. So we are working with stakeholders to design and stand up a program here in Wisconsin in two rural and one urban communities yet to be determined to try this here in Wisconsin to make it a Wisconsin.
When you say hub and spoke, what do you mean by that?
Mm-hmm. So it is a care coordination kind of model that integrates the variety of kinds of services that somebody with a substance abuse disorder needs, both on the primary healthcare side, but also on the treatment and recovery side. And so it requires coordination in a way that supports an individual to get and stay healthy and seek recovery.
So moving on to vaping, the Children's Hospital of Wisconsin recently treated 8 teenagers with severe lung damage. Each had vaped in the months prior. What do we know about the dangers of vaping, and what should the state be doing about it?
Mm-hmm. So, Kate, I think this is something that folks ought to understand as a fundamental public health responsibility of the Department of Health Services. When our partners at the Milwaukee Children's Hospital alerted us to that first cluster of cases, our disease detectives, our investigators went. They have spoken with all of those patients, with those families, to try to figure out what the commonality among those youth and young adults who have seen this severe lung disease, and that common link is vaping. We continue to investigate it. There are new suspected cases. Illinois now has some cases, so now we're working with the CDC more broadly on this. But it is an important opportunity for us as a public health agency to raise awareness among the public about the potential dangers of vaping. I think one thing we need to be clear about is it is not a safe alternative to traditional cigarettes, and there are folks in that community who try to press that narrative. There is a lot that we do not know about the long-term health effects of vaping. What we do know is that it alters the brain development of adolescents. And so we caution parents to talk to their kids, to convince them not to vape. And we want parents to know that tobacco doesn't look like what it used to look like. Vaping products are designed to be attractive to youth and to kids. And so parents need to know what they look like, and they need to talk to their kids.
We're talking with DHS Secretary Andrea Palm as we explore healthcare issues, policies here in Wisconsin. You can join in. What health issues do you see in your community? What health support is needed? How do you see the opioid crisis playing out where you are? And what health topics or concerns do you have as your kids head back to school? Do they have their vaccinations? You can join in the conversation 800-642-1233. As you reflect on what you want DHS to prioritize. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back with Secretary Andrea Palm in just a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. On a Thursday, you're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And you have a line to DHS Secretary Andrea Palm. We're looking at some of the issues that the Department of Health Services is working on, including addressing our state's aging population. Wisconsin's elderly population is projected to grow 6 times faster than the overall population by 2040. Wisconsin's share of people 65 and older is expected to grow to 1.5 million by 2040. So how are elderly people in your community getting along? What support services are needed? And what do you want to ask the leader of DHS? We're at 800-642-1234, and Secretary Palm stays with us. Secretary, nursing homes in Wisconsin have been closing. They're struggling to stay afloat. In the black, they say, due to challenges covering costs. How much of a problem is this trend considering our state's aging population?
It's a great question, Kate. I think one of the things that we are really focused on figuring out at DHS is exactly that question. And I think one of the confluence of factors here around an aging population and then a preference by seniors and others to remain in their homes and communities, in living independently as long as possible, and we have seen a significant rise in assisted living and home and community-based care, both here in Wisconsin and nationally. And that trend is also putting pressure on nursing homes because there are now these home and community-based alternatives. And so how those things fit together, how we respect seniors' desire to remain at home and in their communities, close to their neighbors and friends for as long as possible, yet make sure that the infrastructure exists so when they do need higher levels of care, nursing home care, that is available all across the state of Wisconsin is something that we are focused on. As you suggest, we know the population is aging, and so this is a problem that we should be being strategic and thoughtful about so that we are prepared for it when it gets here, because there's really not a good excuse for us not to be prepared considering we understand the demographics of this state.
And then looking at the worker shortage, there was this report last year that found more than 1,600 vacant caregiver positions at Wisconsin's about 400 nursing homes. So what do we know about this worker shortage?
Yeah, caregivers are a critical part of the system, and the shortages exist in nursing homes, in assisted living, in the facilities that the DHS operates that provide 24/7 care to folks who need it. So it is absolutely a critical issue. There was considerable money in the budget for us to focus on wages and supports for this particular workforce, and we're working quickly to get that money out the door. We think it's an important tool to retain and attract folks into this profession, and so we certainly are focused on it. The governor also issued an executive order earlier this spring on caregiving, and we will be announcing the members of that task force and begin our work to look at the workforce issues around caregiving and things we need to be doing as a state to make sure we have the qualified workforce that we need now and moving forward. So it will continue to be a focus for us.
When does that task force get going and the people named to it?
Very soon.
Okay.
We are finalizing that right now, and folks should be on the lookout for the announcement.
So here we are, summer winding down, families going back to school. How concerned are you about children's vaccination rates as we head into the new school year?
So I think, obviously, again, as the public health agency, we are very interested and desire folks to get their required immunizations. It's important for their own health. It's important for the health of folks who, because of compromised immune systems, can't themselves be vaccinated. So us protecting each other is an important part of getting and being current on your immunizations. We think back to school time is a good opportunity to sort of check and make sure that we're all up to date. And yesterday we released some resources for parents and for kids as they think about going back to school, including the immunization schedule, a link to a place where you can find providers and other resources that will help parents and families get ready to go back to school healthy and ready to learn.
Do you feel your agency would be prepared to handle a major measles outbreak?
So interesting, Kate. We keep coming back to these fundamental public health responsibilities of the department, and we are. It is something that we are tracking very closely. Obviously, there are outbreaks in states all across the country, including many of our neighboring states, and so we watch very closely. We track suspected cases and have been doing that since I arrived here in Wisconsin. And they were doing it before, certainly. But the vigilance around tracking suspected cases until we know whether they are or whether they are not confirmed cases of measles is a critical part of how you respond to an outbreak, because if you find one confirmed case, then you chase all of the people they've been in contact with as a way to limit the spread of the disease. And so being on top of all those suspected cases is a critical part of that. We obviously currently do not have a measles case in Wisconsin, but we remain vigilant and will continue our very active surveillance around anything we see that might look like measles in the state of Wisconsin.
Talking with Wisconsin's top health official, Secretary Andrea Palm. Your questions, 800-642-1234. I want to get to lead. This week, Republican lawmakers introduced a couple bills to tackle lead in the drinking water at schools, daycares, group homes, summer camps. We saw that Governor Evers recently created a new position in the administration to address lead concerns. What is the best course of action here when it comes to addressing lead in our drinking water?
Mm-hmm. So this executive order and our work more broadly focuses on lead across the spectrum. Our role will be to coordinate those efforts. So while DNR is and will continue to be the point on lead in water, and we, you know, we provide scientific expertise and assistance to them as they look at what the quality standards for lead and other things that are in water, so that we make sure that anything that is present there is at a level that it does not introduce health effects into the system. And so they set those standards. We help advise them scientifically, and we'll continue to do that. But for the Department of Health Services, our primary responsibilities and focus are around lead in homes. And what we know is that of the approximately 4,000 children who are lead poisoned every year in the state of Wisconsin, the primary source of that lead is in their homes, and that is lead paint. And so we are working to draw down new federal dollars to invest in abatement activities in older homes. And so we will continue to focus on what is a primary source of lead poisoning of children, and that is their own homes, and particularly homes that were built in the 1950s and certainly before 1978, when we stopped using lead paint in residentials.
In our last few seconds with you, what lessons learned at the federal level? You spent so many years in D.C. What can you take from there that you can bring to Wisconsin and use on the ground in Wisconsin?
Mm-hmm. What I really hope that I bring to the state of Wisconsin is a broad understanding of programs that impact people all over the state. And, the acronym soup of all of these programs are things I've been working on for decades and worked on at the federal level. And so since I've come to Wisconsin, it's really given me the opportunity to focus on learning Wisconsin, learning the specifics of how Wisconsin has implemented them, how they've been creative to deliver for the people of the state. But I hope that it has shortened my learning curve as it relates to the broad scope of the Department of Health Services, and really allowed me to dig in to the Wisconsin specifics to deliver for the people of the state.
Secretary, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kate. Have a good day.
Andrea Palm is Secretary Designee of the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, previously served as Senior Counsel to the Secretary of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services under President Obama. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.